Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's call. All participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you'll have a chance to ask questions during the Q&A session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing star then one on your touch-tone telephone. You may remove yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. Please note today's call will be recorded. I will be standing by if you should need any assistance, and it is now my pleasure to turn the program over to Rachel Newsom. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us today for our briefing, Coronavirus and Health System Capacity, State Projections. I'm Rachel Newsom, Vice President for Federal and State Health Policy at the Commonwealth Fund. For those of you that don't know, the Commonwealth Fund is a nonpartisan health policy research foundation aimed at creating a high-performing U.S. health system. Today's call is part of a Commonwealth Fund Alliance for Health Policy series on health system capacity. Today, we'll talk specifically about state capacity and current projections for how we can meet the COVID-19 demand. We will address what can be done to ensure timely data collection for accurate projections so that states can quickly address shortages from workforce to ventilators and accommodate a rising number of patients. The pandemic will touch every corner of our healthcare system, but we only have 45 minutes today, and we're going to be very focused specifically on the impact of COVID-19 on states' healthcare infrastructure. We plan to address other health policy-related aspects of system capacity, such as getting supplies to providers and patients, as well as vaccine and product development in future briefings in the coming weeks, and with our next teleconference on Monday. I'm joined today by Nirav Shah, co-founder of COVID-X Now and senior scholar at Stanford University Clinical Excellence Research Center, as well as David Radley, senior scientist of tracking health system performance at the Commonwealth Fund, and finally, Andy Slavitt, the former acting administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and the board chair of United States of Care. Nirav, David, and Andy will provide some brief remarks on how state capacity for a COVID-19 response should be measured, what states can do to gear up for an influx of patients, and the implications for states with different capacities to respond. As a reminder, we will take questions after the remarks, but you can enter the queue now for questions by pressing star one. We're going to start with Nirav Shah, and I will turn it over to Nirav to talk about his work with COVID-X Now and various models to help us look at the COVID-19 pandemic. Nirav?
Thank you, Rachel, and thanks for everyone for joining. We build models to predict the future based on what we've seen in the past. Right now, we're working off of data from Spain, Italy, and other countries to come up with what we think might happen in Iowa, Florida, and New York. But we do need signals in real time to tell us where to focus our attention. Exactly 2 weeks ago, Max Henderson and other volunteers launched COVID-X Now to answer the most pressing questions. What data do decision makers need to act now? And the first order of business was to get states to issue a stay-at-home order or a shelter-in-place order. That would flatten the curve and ultimately save lives. Well, over the last 2 weeks, by showing actual hospital capacity and the best estimates of when that hospital capacity might be overrun, officials in Michigan, Colorado, Alaska, Hawaii, and many others have credited the data from COVIDACTNOW.org for their decision. Other models also help policymakers in real time. We've seen that surveillance data in real time from healthweather.us tracking temperatures of people using a million smart thermometers in homes have been some of the best estimates of where is COVID in the community. Data from Unicast has been using mobility data from GPS signals on cell phones to show people how good are your shelter-in-place or stay-at-home orders actually working. They compare how much people are moving around compared to historical estimates. We still need much more data and many more models. One of the biggest questions that come up nowadays is, how fast can we get back to work? I think it's a false choice between people's lives and people's livelihoods. Today, we have to focus on lives, and that way, by shutting down all non-essential businesses, aggressively keeping people at home, we can then ultimately get back to work and get back to people's livelihoods. I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you so much, Nirav. I did want to point out that on the Commonwealth Fund's website, You can find the COVID Act Now resources that Nirav mentioned, as well as the resources that Dave will reference as well. So Dave, with that, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Rachel. So as the COVID-19 disease and the underlying coronavirus spreads, you know, state leaders are left trying to mobilize healthcare resources, and they're quickly coming to terms with the capacity that they have in their states to handle a potential surge in COVID-19 cases. So one of the things that we do at the Commonwealth Fund is we catalog different aspects of the healthcare delivery system. We've been doing it for a long time, and this is the first time we've done it in a pandemic, thankfully. But what we've done is we've pulled together state-level estimates of population risk, hospital capacity, and physician supply that we hope gives context to state and federal policymakers who are working through their own response scenarios. I'm going to walk through a couple really high level, a couple of those data points now, but what I would do is refer you to the Commonwealth Fund website, commonwealthfund.org, where you can download an Excel file that has all of the data that that I'll be speaking about right now. So when we look across states, of course, every state has some portion of their population that are either older age or that are younger age, but they have a chronic illness. We're all susceptible to developing COVID-19 if we're exposed to the underlying virus. But we know that people with chronic illnesses and that older adults are much more susceptible to the most severe symptoms if they do develop COVID-19. And so when we look across states, we see that states vary a small amount, from about 36% of their population falling into one of these high-risk categories to about 53%. And so, of course, every state has a significant at-risk population. We do see a cluster, though, of states in the southern part of the country where a much higher share of their population does fall into one of these high-risk categories. They may be prone, should COVID really surge in those states, they may be prone to a little bit more need for hospital services, if they're a little bit sicker. One of the things that we also did was we took a look at physician supply. We looked at physician supply sort of under current scenarios where we take a look at primary care physicians and medical specialists who can sort of triage and manage patients in the community, as well as physicians that are managing patients in hospitals. Then we also looked at a surge scenario where we look at the added physician capacity in states where physicians who are medically trained but may not be providing patient care as their primary responsibility, where those added physicians may transition to the front lines of care and provide patient care. Sort of naturally, we see a lot of variation across states. And I think this is really, when we look at those numbers, it's really an indication of how much capacity states have sort of to try to be able to mobilize as they're developing their responses. It's not necessarily a situation where we're thinking that one state is more prepared or less prepared, but rather, these are the resources that states have to work with. We did the same thing for hospital bed capacity, where we take a look at acute care bed supply, ICU bed supply, ventilator supply. And again, we sort of mapped out where each state falls in terms of those types of resources. What we're seeing is that states really are sort of emerging as the locus of policy action on trying to mitigate the spread of COVID-19 and to try to mobilize the resources that they have available. I think what's clear from our data is that all states are going to face big challenges if and when COVID cases surge in their states. We hope that the resources that we're putting together help give some context to the people trying to manage their responses. Thank you.
Great, Dave. Thank you so much. Now I'd like to turn it to Andy Andy Slavitt to talk about what's being done at the state level to really expand capacity and really prepare for the surge that Dave has referenced. Thanks so much.
At this point, I'd say that most states, since every day is a century now, I'll talk about yesterday's century, which will, of course, be different as we move forward. But most states have developed a model thanks to the work of the great people on this call. And the problem with the governors have is there's an incredibly wide range of when the peak date is, when the number of cases. And of course, it's the reason that that's the case is because it's highly dependent upon the infection rate in their state. And it's a moving target because of the built-in lag you have between symptom onset, hospitalization, need for ICU beds and vents. You have sort of a classic situation where they're sort of having to bet on the future. And I think what many of the states have said, if you put aside, I think, the three biggest hotspots right now of New York, New Orleans, and Detroit, people who are going later still have an opportunity to influence what that peak level is and whether they'll be able to manage it based upon how much the curve is flattened. And it's amazing how many governors now speak this lingo. But, I talked to several governors who've said if the peak flattens well, enough, they may be okay. And the peak date could be in May or June. And they have other people telling them that their worst case is the peak date is right around the corner, in which case they don't have nearly enough. So, I've been talking to them about picking the most realistic scenario they can, because the cost of being wrong is twofold. They're conscious of one side of the cost of being wrong, which is if they underestimate, they end up with people dying in hallways in their hospitals. That's very hard for anybody to stomach, certainly a governor. But if they're wrong the other way, then someone in one of the other 49 states may suffer. So when they put forward estimates that say, out of an abundance of caution, I'm just going to add another 1,000 vents, or I'm going to be cautious, which under normal circumstances with abundant supply would be very logical for a governor to do. You'd want there to be some hedge. Well, we don't have room for hedge right now. And so one of the things that's going on is that FEMA is trying to assess on a day-by-day basis what they think the realistic needs of the states are. And what you're hearing, even out of the presidential press conference, is that they hear numbers out of states that are larger than what they think. Now, who's right? It's impossible to know. But one of the consequences is that FEMA is buying up ventilators left and right, requiring wherever they can. And if states want more than that because they don't agree with the federal government, they're having to go out in the open market and purchase. And this is where they're competing against other states. And, at this point in time, you can buy, if a state wants to buy a ventilator, which is, I think, only one of two or three of the critical examples, they would be paying $45,000 is the current market price for a $15,000 ventilator. Now, the good news is if you can push the curve back, production capacity is going to be coming online in early May. It'll ramp up. But, by May or June, there will be significant supply of ventilators. And between the Strategic Reserve Stockpile, the VA, vents that are in Afghanistan, there is a logistics game that needs to be played much, much better than it has. I've only focused on one element of what governors are thinking about today. Obviously, they're thinking about testing. Obviously, they're thinking about PPE and their staff. And they're really wrestling, and with this one final point that I'll mention, then I'll push it back, is they're really wrestling with how long they can sustain people's ability to stay home. And they are worried not just sociologically, but economically. And they don't feel like they have the ability to control the answer to that question. So without knowing whether there's more help from the federal government, a lot of governors believe that once it gets to April 30th, they're going to be facing significant challenge, and many of them are understanding that if they don't have testing and contact tracing and other things in place, that when they do that, they're going to see a bounce back from the, you know, the 2.3 to 1.4, which many of them have gained and are not, they'll see a bounce back, and maybe we'll be a little bit better prepared, but not much. So that's what they're trying to figure out now. They're facing a Hobbesian choice. I don't think that it's a matter of what scientists tell them versus what economists tell them. I think it's a matter of how they manage the situation carefully, and they're looking for help and looking for answers.
Thank you, Andy. I wanted to ask you just one quick follow-up question before we go to our questions, and a reminder to folks, if you have a question for any of our three speakers, to push star one, and you can be entered in the question queue right now. Andy, you mentioned the outlier hotspots of New York, Louisiana, and Detroit. Are there similar factors happening in all of those hotspot areas? What are the similarities that we think we're seeing? Very different regions, very different weather patterns, different even populations. So do we have a sense of what's happening there that's similar, that are really driving some of these hotspots, or not yet?
Well, you know, I think it's this is nothing that I have a proprietary answer for, but, you know, the earlier you started and the more you sustained it, the more successful people have been at being able to socially isolate, the better. And you've got to compare that to the density of the population and the resources already in place in a state. Louisiana, obviously New York is extremely densely populated. Louisiana, I think people point to Mardi Gras, but I think there's other factors as well. You've got a lot of low-income populations. You've got multi-generation households where people are going out working, coming back with their parents and grandparents living with them, a lot of people living in poverty. In Detroit, they don't have Mardi Gras, but they've got similar challenges. I call those three out, not because they're necessarily, Louisiana New Orleans is the worst in the world right now, as far, at least the last time I looked. But they all three have shortages, well-identified shortages and near-term either peaks or excessive demand. So that's what's unique. Whereas Washington State, they had 29 deaths. Santa Clara had one early death, and they got religion fast. And so they stem the flow.
Well, Andy, I don't know that Santa Clara has stemmed the flow. They're certainly doing all the right actions. But if you saw the governor from California talk over 4 days this past week, the number of people hospitalized have doubled, and the number of people requiring ICU beds have tripled in 4 days. So I would argue that all states are at some point along the curve. The faster that we tamp it down, the faster we get strict social isolation measures in place. We want to be wrong as modelers, and we want us to have all the models fail and show that we're not going to have a worst-case scenario. But the reality on the ground today is that without adequate testing, we don't know how it's spreading. We know there's many cases in the community, and different states are just at different places along that continuum.
Thanks for that clarification.
Okay, I think we're ready to take our first question in the queue.
Certainly. We'll go first to David Smiley with the Miami Herald. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. Wondering if anyone in this call has had an opportunity or to have any conversations or correspondence with government officials in the state of Florida, and whether any information has been requested or shared or anything like that.
So this is Andy, not directly with Governor DeSantis. Colleagues of mine have had conversations with some of the mayors we tried to, as much as possible, start contacting mayors when we were seeing less forceful action at the governor's level. And so Not sure whether or not the mayors are, I wasn't on those calls, to be frank, but I got readouts from them, and I'm not sure, I couldn't tell whether or not they were equipped. They certainly sounded quite worried and on top of the fact that they had challenges.
Yes, I've been in touch with several mayors in Florida, including with St. Augustine, Tampa, and others about what they might be able to do, and they're certainly very receptive.
Gotcha. Has anybody reached out to the state at all by any chance?
We have attempted to, and I understand those conversations are ongoing.
Okay. Thank you.
And next we'll go to Dan Goldberg with Politico. Please go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for doing this. I wanted to ask, I know you've looked at some county-level data, too. Are there areas of states based on the number of doctors and ICU beds, et cetera, that are more prone than others? So, for example, in Georgia, is it more to the western part of the state, which, you know, or Atlanta, or in, you know, is it more Nashville, or is it more Memphis in Tennessee? Can you speak to anything a little bit more granular?
This is Nirav. I'll speak first. I know that what I've seen is that there's a direct correlation between bold, decisive action and tamping it down of the curves. The data from KINSA has shown with the fever mapping that those municipalities that have made a difference are those that have actually put the shelter in place earlier rather than later, but that such policies work. And so to the extent that the best indicator of who's at risk is how tamped down are you in your social distancing? Are you actually enforcing only essential businesses staying open? Those kinds of policies directly correlate with how fast things are spreading across America.
And Naran, just to clarify, if they go to the COVID-X Now tool, they would be able to dig in and see where some of the data is showing up within the state.
Just go to healthweather.us. You can see every county that KINSA has data for.
Yeah, and in addition to the healthweather.us, there's many other sites out there looking at different data sets to try to get to understand how well social distancing is working. And I think that all of them provide different pictures of the truth. And collectively, depending on what your question is, there's a lot of good data out there already.
Google came out with a tool this morning. It's not at the county level. It's at the state level, which uses anonymized cell phone data to track how the mobility, they've got like a mobility index for mm-hmm. each state. It's not as useful. It does show that people are getting it, and what Rob said is exactly right. If you look at date of action and graph it against the reductions in whether it's mobility, whether it's and some other kind of marker for spread, it's very clear that the more decisive and the more early and more sustained the action, the better.
And we'll move next to Jamie Fraser with USA Today. Please go ahead.
Hello. I was hoping that you could talk to what particular factors you are encouraging leaders to consider when weighing the various data models out there. You know, what are the things that make a model more reliable or more useful? And with all of these novel approaches like, you know, electronic thermometers and things, you know, is there precedent for that? Or are we using some data that we don't really know in the long run how reliable it'll be?
Yes, let me start with that. Thank you. That's a great question. There's five things that you should do to evaluate a model. First, does it reflect reality at a high level? You know, are they numbers in the right order of magnitude? Are they moving in the right direction? Are they matching other countries that are ahead of us in the pandemic? Second, is the model robust? Does it make assumptions that are risky? What decisions does this lead us to? What would happen to our decision if this model were 10% wrong, 50% wrong, or 90% wrong? Third, is it transparent? Can you review it? is how it works easily explained or understood, and can you connect with the team and ask those questions? Fourth, is it clear about unknowns and limitations? Do the modelers openly admit what they don't know? Do they articulate what the model is and isn't good for? And are they open about the fact that it will change? And fifth, is it vetted? Have outside experts reviewed and endorsed that model?
So let me just add one thing to that. That's all right. And in peacetime, the governors would feel like they'd be able to be more deliberate. The problem they have, and the problem all of us have, is trying to make decisions with very imperfect information and way more unknowns than knowns. And every governor I've talked to has told me they have credible people telling them, giving them very broad ranges, including 6 weeks apart in one state from when they think the peak will be, using the same information. Both highly credible sources, one a university, one a very, very prominent foundation who's expert in this work. And so they call and they say what to believe. And, Nirav is better positioned to pick through the models and help them go through those five factors. But the fact remains that the assumptions in here are largely driven by how well they can sustain social distancing, and they really don't know. And so at the end of the day, the question that they have is a more practical one, which is how conservative am I able to be in this moment? And how conservative should I be in this moment?
Yeah, part of it is a data problem, as you point out, Andy. You know, to the extent that if we had a perfect test and it was broadly distributed, we wouldn't need a model. We'd have a reflection of a reality that's a perfect mirror. We know what's going on in the community. Short of that, we're using deaths. Deaths from COVID are a very late indicator. It's a lagging indicator. It's too late by the time you get people dying. So what are we relying on is how many people are hospitalized in each state. That is actually a very good number. Unfortunately, only half the states are reporting it out on a daily basis. Today, the call to action should be report out your data transparently so that we can actually understand how your state is going to be at risk and where along the curve you are.
And can you talk broadly about, if a state is not sharing their data on a timely basis or in a transparent way, what effect does that have on, the models for that particular state, but also for, nationwide models or leaders making a decision at a broader level?
Today, local public health, 3,500 local public health collect the data. Then they roll it up to the county, from the county up to the state, from the state up to the CDC, and from the CDC, it eventually gets to Johns Hopkins. So what are you looking at for your data? You're looking at delayed data signals. We need much faster real-time data that's reliable, and that does not exist today.
Grav, I have a question for you. I don't know if that's allowed. Did you read the Michael Lewis article, and what do you think of it? Is it helpful, a piece of the puzzle? As a leading indicator?
I haven't seen that yet. I'm sorry.
So I'll give you just 10, I'll give you 30 seconds, 15 seconds on it. It effectively uses the report, people who report a lack of losing a sense of smell, as which apparently something like 80% of people who lose a sense of smell have COVID, and something like the reverse, but only 40% of people who have COVID have lose their sense of smell. So they're using that, they're arguing that that's a potential intelligence signal, early indicator as well.
It is. Three patients in my clinic last week at Stanford had lost their sense of smell, and that was very concerning, but actually very consistent with all the other symptoms of COVID. So I think it's a great signal. It's just one signal among many. We don't know how that changes depending on age, depending on race, depending on many other factors. And so I think we should use that data point along with many other data points. Unfortunately, people like their one data point and tend to stick to it. To the extent that we can start to crowdsource and thoughtfully come up with better models, that would be an important next step.
This is where we are is more like the stock market than where people in healthcare like it to be, which is you've got to triangulate. You've got to look at perceptions. You've got to make decisions under uncertainty because we just don't have the time. And so we can wish we had more data. We can wish we had testing capacity. And, you know, someday I look forward to kicking and screaming about why we didn't. But the key thing to do now is to just help the governors and the federal government get enough data to make the best decisions. And if this could be done more uniformly, we would prevent the hoarding and the other things that are, quite frankly, adding to the risk, not reducing it.
I have a question for Andy, actually. The U.S. of CARE, you've been talking a lot about some of the other areas which we haven't touched upon. I'm very worried that 10 million people filed unemployment claims in the last 2 weeks and that most people in America get their health insurance through their employer. What will it mean when we have so many people who don't have health care?
Well, the president's increasingly getting pushed on this issue. He claims he's got a solution for it. I'm not so sure whether he does or whether he doesn't. He's said that before, and this isn't to take a shot at him necessarily. But between the Congress and him, they're going to have to solve that. This is where the ideological lines haven't entirely broken down. In the first three bills, it's been very tough to get that on the table. There's even been elements of the bill, and as many on the phone might know, rules coming out of CMS that are going to make it harder for states to use Medicaid money. And there was a poison pill that was taken out of the bill at the last minute that would have caused hundreds of thousands more people to lose Medicaid. So, you know, sadly, we still have these ideological battles that are going on. Hopefully, it won't take even more loss of life for them to reconcile to these issues.
Nirav, and for the benefit of everyone else on the phone, a colleague at the Commonwealth Fund, Dr. Sarah Collins, wrote a blog post yesterday that we published on our website yesterday that articulates what people can do if they lose their coverage through their job, and it sort of runs through different scenarios and who's eligible for what. I would encourage everybody on the phone to go take a look at that blog post. It lays it out in very clear terms exactly what people's options are.
And next we'll go to Lynn Anderson with The Conversation. Please go ahead.
Thanks, y'all, so much for doing this. This question is mainly for Andy. Andy, you were talking about the incredibly wide range of the problems that the governors face, and then also the difficulty they face in trying to help people sustain their abilities to stay home. So in this environment in which each state is dealing with the crisis in its own way, how then on a national level are we going to have some uniformity in knowing when to come out of this? Because based on what happened in Hong Kong, other parts of Asia, when some have come out of it, then obviously this comes roaring back. So how are we going to know with this kind of individualized the problems that each state's facing? What's going to happen with that?
I would strongly encourage the federal government and the states to follow what I think is the best roadmap we have out there right now, which is the paper from AEI that I'm sure most of you have seen, that co-authored by Scott Gottlieb, Mark McClellan, and a few others. And that paper, as of this moment in time, is the best we have in terms of laying out, here are the things that need to change in order for us to move from phase one to phase two to phase three to phase four and to open up the economy. I think those should be uniform standards. I think the National Academy of Science should be in charge of determining them, and I think as states can evolve to that, that can really help. And we are trying to work with a few states to develop what we are loosely calling South Korea models, so that they can demonstrate that by doing a handful of things, a lot of them are the things that Nirav and I and others talked about on this call, they can demonstrate best results while we increase manufacturing capacity in the country. It's not precisely South Korea, but it is some of those elements. So in a perfect world, we would have a defined set of standards, and then we would look at each locality and we would see where they were on those standards. It's far from a perfect world. In the meantime, there's going to be enormous pressure, enormous pressure on governors before they get to those points to start to relax things. And this is in the something's got to give category. So we know we won't do it perfectly. Most of the scientists I talk to, and I spend almost every evening talking to a set of scientists, Homeland Security experts, basically say, we know exactly what we need to do, and we know for sure that we won't be able to do it. So, you know, that's how scientists talk, by the way, to me at least. So, we're going to have to wrestle through that.
And we'll go next to Leora Engel-Smith with North Carolina Health News. Please go ahead.
Hi. So I wanted to know a little more about those disparities that were mentioned a little bit before. Like, where are we seeing, what's emerging in terms of disparities in COVID diagnosis and COVID deaths? Because, part of it is like availability of testing, so it's hard for me to sort of know what's happening.
Well, I think the answer is we don't know yet because there is so much unknown. We don't have the data to say that this community is not getting the treatment they need versus that community because it's all still unknown. It's early days for us. What we do know from prior experience with other conditions is that underserved communities, those without health insurance, the homeless, undocumented, and others, tend to have very poor access to health care. And right now, this is a healthcare solution or healthcare-focused solution with public health layered on top. As a result, we suspect that those communities that I mentioned are also going to be hardest hit. They often are the densest living in many ways and are also going to access healthcare much later, which means that they're not going to get the early action that they need to stem the flow.
This is Rachel
Thank
from
you.
The Commonwealth Fund. I would just add that we have data that shows from some survey data that when asked, a lot of Americans are still very concerned about treatment costs, and more than a majority of the respondents have indicated that concerns around the cost of accessing treatment would be a barrier for them accessing treatment if they had symptoms. So that's another factor to keep in mind in terms of population.
And we'll move next to Erin Mansfield with USA Today. Please go ahead.
Hi, my question is for Mr. Slavitt. You tweeted a couple days ago that the DOD had access to 8,000 ventilators, and you mentioned that might be enough so that people don't have to die in hallways. Do you know if they've sent them out? Do you think those will be enough? And what is FEMA's responsibility?
So they haven't, as far as I know. They sent some, and I think we know they sent some that haven't been working. This is a perfect example of where transparency would be incredibly helpful. The taxpayers own those machines. So we should understand exactly how many there are. We should understand how many are working and how many aren't. There are companies that are volunteering to fix the ones that aren't working. And then the choices they have to make are: we have, I think, three fires right now that these 8,000 plus ventilators could help put out. I think the sense I have from the administration is they also don't want to leave those in the second wave, which they believe will be more rural areas, in the lurch. And so I think the plan that they are needing to really execute, and I think they can, is to give those states that need them now, New York, along with Michigan and Louisiana, and then use some of the other resources, such as the production coming online in early May, VA production, the ventilators that are in Afghanistan, all of those things. The problem is people like me have to imperfectly hunt for this information, and I'm not a media person, I'm not a reporter. There are people who do a far better job of it than I will or can. But what I get told, it doesn't go through the double confirmation that reporters need to go through. but I have reliable people tell me stuff, and I put it out there and ask for people to refute it, and nobody does. Or if they do, I will mention that. But I shouldn't have to do that. We should have a very transparent set of data coming out of the administration. For better or worse, people can handle it. And I don't think what we need is a defense of their actions. We recognize this is hard. There's no success other than saving as many lives as possible. And I don't know how we can save as many lives as possible when everyone has to guess what's available and when it's available.
And I just wanted to kind of follow up to clarify. DOD announced, I think it was last Saturday, that they were going to get 8,000 more from some of their existing contracts. But then there's also something like 9 or 10,000 in the stockpile. Where does the 8,000 you're aware of fit in?
I don't know how many the DOD has. I do know the DOD has some, and I have heard that there are a large number in Afghanistan. I've gotten a number that's in the thousands. I'm not quite sure what's exactly right. The amount that we know of are the 8,000 plus in the strategic reserve, and I'm unsure of how many of those are fully functioning and how many of those need repair.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
And we'll go next to Sarah Mueller with Florida Politics. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. My question is, I was wondering if you guys had a comment on the stay-at-home order that Governor DeSantis recently issued this week. He did do a stay-at-home order statewide, but then did a second order that preempted local restrictions that went further than his order, and then also in that order exempted like mega churches and stuff like that, so they can still have people gather in churches. You know, there was the Hillsborough pastor that, you know, gained national attention for having a big Sunday gathering. I was just wondering if you could comment, like, on how stuff like that could, you know, having big church services and stuff like that, is that problematic, in your opinion, towards, you know, trying to combat the spread? And do you think that Florida is doing enough to, you know, flatten the curve?
So this is Nira. I'll start. I'll say this is – go ahead. Go ahead, Andy.
I was going to say no. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's the right answer. The virus doesn't respect borders, and different policies from one county to the next, one state to the next, are not going to win this war. It's an exponential disease. It's completely outside of our experience, and we can't fight it with traditional tools. We have to act now. We have to flatten the curve to prevent death. Ventilators are – saving half the people who get put on them. Ventilators are not the answer. It's the upstream public health, social distancing, aggressive lockdowns that are going to save lives.
Hi. Sorry.
What more do you think that the state should be doing?
I'm going to have to jump off the call. Do you want me to try to answer one more question? Or is that, Nira, do you want that?
Go ahead.
What more should the states be doing? Is that the question?
Yeah, well, what more should Florida be doing?
Oh, okay. I've got a live radio interview, so I'm going to go. Nirav can nail that question.
Yeah.
All right, bye,
so,
guys.
Thank you. So we know what's going to what works and what doesn't work. We know from the experience of countries like Taiwan, which is 80 miles from the border of China, they've been able to tamp down the disease by doing aggressive social distancing, by testing broadly, by doing contact tracing of 300 people for every possible COVID case in the community. Those are the kinds of actions, aggressive, bold, decisive, that are needed to actually get this under control. Across America, we are not there yet. We have highly variable levels of stay-at-home and shelter-in-place. The more you do, the more your people will be safe. That's the simple answer. And at the individual level, stay at home means actually that. Stay at home. Don't go grocery shopping every day. Send a 30-year-old or younger person to go once a week for you. There are very simple things that we can do. The CDC website talks about it extensively. The World Health Organization talks about it extensively. This is not new. It's already been done. And if you fail, you end up like Italy. And if you succeed, you end up like South Korea or Taiwan.
And we have no further questions at this time, so I'd like to return the floor to our speakers.
Great. Thank you so much. I just want to once again thank our three speakers today, Nirav Shah, David Radley, and Andy Slavitt. And thank you so much for all of you for joining us. This has been recorded. It'll be available on our website along with the resources that our speakers mentioned and referenced today. If you did have any questions we didn't get to, please feel free to reach out to us by email. And wanted to make sure that folks were aware that our next teleconference is on Monday, April 6th, on prescription drugs and the vaccine development pipeline with our experts, Mark McClellan at Duke University and Peggy Hamburg, both former FDA commissioners, and we hope you can join. So with that, thank you so much. Thank you again to our panelists. Stay home and stay safe, and have a great day.